First of all, greetings from Pennsylvania, and thanks to a couple folks who made this happen tonight. Thanks to Adam for the introduction. Thanks to Rich. Where's Jeff? Thanks to Jeff Reifman, one-armed Jeff. That's his nickname for the next couple weeks. We were joking to a city councilman today in a meeting that the venues for us have really come full circle. From 1998 to 2002, we rarely set foot in a city councilman's office or some other formal venue like a college campus that folks generally travel around and speak to. Our meetings instead took place in a much different kind of place, salt sheds, where our municipal officials keep salt to clear the roads in the winter, the basements of the smallest churches in the smallest of places in central Pennsylvania, one-room schoolhouses that are still used for municipal buildings in south and north central Pennsylvania. Churches were always a common place for us to speak. And our work over those years, over the past 8 years, has been very different than work done by conventional environmental attorneys. Although it started out that way, it's become something much different. The Legal Defense Fund that Adam mentioned was launched in 1995 to do one, what we thought was one very simple thing, one very simple, straightforward thing that has become exceedingly complex after we began the Legal Defense Fund. It was to deal with the cost of legal services in the United States. Environmental attorneys now cost between $200 and $400 an hour for grassroots organizations to retain an attorney. Generally, groups don't have two dimes to rub together and can't afford legal counsel. For municipal governments who take care of roads and have budgets smaller than some nonprofit groups, those folks forced to hire attorneys expend the same amount of funds. And so when I came out of law school, we framed the problem in a certain way. Adam made a comment about so few public interest attorneys in the United States. There are only 200 full-time public interest attorneys in the United States. 200 full-time. Pennsylvania, we have four. And count them on one hand. And so when we frame the issue as simply lack of access to affordable legal services, the solution seemed exceedingly clear. The solution, of course, was to increase the body of attorneys who were able, had the resources to serve as clients like grassroots environmental organizations. And so in the beginning years, phase one, from 1995 to 1997, we became the best darn conventional environmental attorneys that we could be. Citizen groups would come to us with a range of different single issues. We've all known these groups or read about them. Toxic waste incinerator comes into the neighborhood or wants to come in. A quarry, a landfill, a factory farm, a hog factory farm, sludge to be land applied. Thousands of different single issues across this country that pop up every day in different communities, and communities try to deal with them. Well, what happens when grassroots communities come together to fight a specific issue? They give themselves a name like Citizens Against the Quarry or Citizens for Good Government or Residents Against This or Residents Against That. Well, dollars to donuts, they pick up the phone and they call somebody. And who do they call? Well, generally they call an attorney, hopefully an environmental attorney. And they pick up the phone, and they call this person, and they say, we really don't want this thing in our community. We don't want this toxic waste incinerator. We don't want this quarry. We don't want this landfill. We just don't want it. And the attorney backs up and sits down in a meeting with the community group, and he says, well, that's really great that you don't want it in your community. But unfortunately, under the laws that are structured in this country, you don't have a choice. You can regulate the facility a little better, perhaps. You can make the facility operate a little bit better and minimize the adverse environmental impacts. But you don't have the right to say no. It's a legal use. Toxic waste incinerator gets a permit from the Environmental Protection Agency, whatever it is at the state level, issues the permit. It's legal. It's lawful. It's lawful harm. It's not called permitting for nothing from the agency. So the attorney automatically begins to shuffle the group in a different direction. Group is very firm. They're saying, we don't want this in our community. It's not part of our vision, our sustainable future for this community. And instead of helping the group develop that understanding, work towards something much more fundamental, the attorney instead takes them down this long permit route regulatory hearings. The organization has cake and cookie sales to raise $10,000, $15,000 to pay for the attorney to do the work. And by God, that's what we used to do. We used to get called in by community groups and give them the advice that, well, the only thing you can do is fight the permit process. Maybe you get the permit overturned. Maybe you make it too expensive for the corporation to site the facility there. Maybe, just maybe, after 5 years and raising $10,000 or $15,000 and flushing it down the old legal toilet, maybe, just maybe, you'll be able to keep the facility out of your community. Bad news is, even if you keep it out, it goes in next door. Goes in down the road. Goes in someplace. Everybody else, every other place is somebody else's backyard. In 1997, after culminating 2 years of doing permit work, and by God, we were good. We would win permit appeals and go in front of Environmental Hearing Board judges, and the judge would look at this checklist that the Environmental Protection Agency has of 30 items that have to be in the permit application. And we would say, Your Honor, number 28, little I, little E, little C is not there. There's no signature on the bond. The company didn't provide the right documentation for the hydrology studies for this quarry that's going in. Or, Your Honor, they didn't do this or didn't do that. And the judge would look at it and say, by gosh, you're right. Line 28, it's not there. Law says it has to be there. Regulations say it has to be there. Somebody didn't sign the right piece of paperwork. And you're right, we're going to overturn this permit. We're going to kick it out. We're going to overturn this permit. So what did we do? Well, we went back to the house of the people that had put the group together in the first place, and we had a victory party. And everybody would clap each other on the back, have a couple beers, say, oh, this is great. The system works. We went through this process. We won. We won. What happened 6 months down the road? Corporation would look at the work that we did in the permit appeal. They'd take a new permit application, and they'd say, thank you very much to us. You identified the gaps and omissions in the permit application. And now we're going to come back, and we filled those in. We have the correct signatures. We now have the correct bonding. We did the right hydrology study. We filled in those holes. Thank you very much for helping us out. Community group would look at us and say, we still want to stop this thing. And we'd look back at them and say, you can't. There's nothing left. There's no levers. There's no triggers. You're done. You're cooked. 6 months down the road, the facility was built. Didn't just happen once. Didn't happen five times. Happen 10 times. That was our work. And so for folks that had gone into environmental law for a much different reason, to protect and preserve this planet of ours and communities that depend on the planet to survive. Instead, what we were really doing was working for the corporations, making their job a little easier, and helping to administer an environmental regulatory system, which we came to understand after 1997 was nothing but an energy sink. Energy sink of resources and of time. Because when you regulate something, you automatically allow it to come in. That's what the word means. Regulate. In essence, we've given up our sovereign right to veto or determine what our community is going to look like in 40, 50, 60 years. And we've settled for a right to regulate. Okay? It's a huge difference. It was about that time that we came to a conclusion that we never would have stated a couple years before. Statement still draws gasps from people, but here goes. There's never been an environmental movement in this country. There's never been an environmental movement in this country. Why do I say that? Well, the last 40 years of the environmental movement has been running from place to place, spot fire to spot fire, trying to put out projects that erupt on the scene. People's movements in this country, however, have been much different. The abolitionists, the suffragists, the populists, they sought to drive themselves and rights for themselves into the Constitution, the fundamental governing framework in this country. Herons, ecosystems, rivers, trees, mountains, they have no rights. under our system. They have no rights. They're property. They are treated as property. At one point in this country, people were property, slaves. Abolitionists didn't work together to put a slavery protection agency in place, after all. They worked for much more fundamental things. We've never had an environmental movement in this country. I'm not even sure what it would look like. That's how much at the beginning of the beginning of the beginning we're at. And so in 1998, our work began to change. It didn't just begin to change because we sat in our law office and said, gee, wouldn't it be a good idea to change and let's go out and try to find some new clients. Fortunately for us, or unfortunately, our phone began to ring off the hook. Began to ring off the hook with a constituency that we were not created to service. Rural municipal governments. And not just 10, 20, 100, 200, 400 rural municipal governments in Pennsylvania started lighting up our phone. Now, there was a reason for that. And just to set the scene in rural Pennsylvania, where we work, who are these folks in rural Pennsylvania? Well, this is south central and north central Pennsylvania. The joke I tell, because I was born in Alabama, is that in Pennsylvania, we have Philadelphia on one side of the state, Pittsburgh on the other, and Mississippi in the middle. Okay? We do 90% of our work in Mississippi. It's rural, Republican, conservative, the guys with the shit-kicker boots and the John Deere hats, as my friend in Texas likes to say, belt buckles that would make a Texan proud. Okay. These are the types of folks that we work with in central Pennsylvania. Now, why were they calling us? Why were they calling an environmental law firm? Well, they were doing it for one simple reason. Corporate factory farms had invaded Pennsylvania. Okay. Now, when I say corporate factory farms, I mean mostly hog production facilities. These are the 5,000 head hog farms that have moved into certain places in the United States. And of course, it's not just factory farms, not these football field size aluminum buildings where they now run hogs through an assembly line production, fatten them up in 60 days and ship them off to the meatpacking plant, feed them anything that it takes to fatten them up from week old bread to marshmallows to cardboard. Is now what they use to fatten hogs up in these facilities. And of course, we're looking at something larger when we think about factory farms, jamming animals into these assembly line production facilities. Four corporations now control 70% of pork production in the United States. Four corporations. I just read a statistic that Kraft controls 60% of cheese production in the United States. This corporate concentration in the food supply is nothing new. We just peeled back the onion and happened to start with pork production. Four corporations, 70% of pork production in this country. We have lost 300,000 farmers in the United States over the last 20 years. 300,000 farmers. We always use the passive word lost, like we can't find them. You know, where did they go? We don't know. They were eliminated. They were eliminated. They were cut out. Because when you run these assembly line production facilities for cheap livestock, cheap meat onto the marketplace, you drive out the independent family farmers who are trying to compete with the multinational agribusiness corporations. 300,000 farmers. We've lost, eliminated, 3,500 independent livestock farmers alone in Pennsylvania over the past 15 years. 3,500. And perhaps the statistic that's most shocking is that death by suicide among farmers has now surpassed equipment-related deaths as the number one cause of death for farmers in the United States. Okay. We're not just eliminating farmers. We're eliminating a culture, a rural culture that's anchored on independent family farming. Now, up to that time in Pennsylvania in 1998, these rural municipalities were no fans of these agribusiness production facilities coming into their neck of the woods. So what did they used to do? Well, they used to pass local laws, ordinances, that targeted manure disposal and manure management from these facilities. Anybody that's been around one of these things knows that the waste from these that the pigs create is enormous. It all goes into open-air lagoon systems, just sits there like a swimming pool that gets emptied twice a year. It's a wonderful sight. And so these municipal governments said, well, we're really concerned about this manure issue, and we're going to use this issue to try to ban or keep factory farms from coming into our neck of the woods. What happened in 1998 was that the state legislature, the House and Senate Agriculture Committees in Pennsylvania, who do all that they can to help agribusiness corporations along, that's their job, is to help them come into Pennsylvania, passed a law dealing with manure disposal. No surprise there. They defined the problem from factory farms not as driving 300,000 farmers out of business, but only manure disposal. If you take care of your manure, you're okay. If you land dispose of it properly, you're okay. Wouldn't have been so bad, but the state legislature, instead of just screwing around with the manure disposal stuff and opening and paving the way for the agribusiness folks, instead took the step of preempting all local governments across the state from passing ordinances that were more stringent than the state law that was put into place. It was one of those changes that went in at 11:30 at night in a dimly lit Senate chamber as the law was going through the legislature. So here are these municipal governments who said, well, we don't want these things. Their citizens were screaming at them, we don't want these things in our community. Our vision for our community does not include 5,000 head hog factory farms coming in, and it certainly doesn't include giving control over our farms to four agribusiness corporations in the United States. And so they turned to their lawyer, their municipal lawyer, and they said, we need to do something about this. And the municipal lawyer said, well, that's too bad. The state legislature has preempted you. And citizens were screaming at their elected officials, we don't want these things to come in. And so we had elected officials caught in a vice, attorney on one side and citizens on the other. And so they lit up our phone lines. We didn't know crap about farming. We didn't know anything about land disposal rates. We didn't know anything about fallow to wean facilities. Shoot, we didn't even know what the four corporations, who they were, that controlled 70% of pork production. But we dug in, because we said, our work up to now, it's been pretty pointless in many ways. Doing the conventional environmental work, we got the awards, we got the funding. People love that stuff, the conventional environmental stuff, about fighting a clean stream permit or a clean air permit. We got invited to the White House for Bill Clinton's Environment Day. That he had. And so we were doing really good, but we thought we're really doing a disservice to these folks, so we need to switch gears. And these 400 municipal governments were clamoring for help, and these folks in rural communities, and so we jumped in with both feet. We started doing research. In Pennsylvania, we have 5,000 head hog factory farms. Those are boutique hog factory farms compared to what they have in the Midwest. You go into the Midwest, they got 200,000, 400,000, 500,000 head hog factory farms. Immense things sprawling across the landscape. We said for sure if there's anybody out there that's dealt with this issue, it's got to be the activists and the farmers and the folks in the Midwest. And sure enough, we tripped over them backwards and never makes the nightly news. But nine states in the Midwest, nine, have adopted laws that ban agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms. Nine states. Where did they come from? Well, it started in Oklahoma in 1914. That's how long ago these things went into gear. Most recently in Nebraska and places like South Dakota. And to make the story even more amazing, it wasn't legislatures that did most of this work. It was people. It was grassroots groups. It was independent family farmers. It was folks that cared about watersheds. It was all kinds of good folks, like the Farmers Union in these states, the one of the only true family farmer, independent family farmer groups. And to make the story even more amazing, some of those folks didn't stop with just passing a statewide law. They drove it into their constitutions. Their constitutions in South Dakota and Nebraska, writing this ban on agribusiness corporate ownership and control of farms. That's pretty amazing stuff. Somebody switched gears there from concentrating on minimizing adverse environmental impacts, from merely regulating factory farms. Let's become experts on parts per million of odor particulates in the air and water pollution, all those good things that environmental lawyers and groups always, we love data. We need more data. Well, these folks said, screw the data. We know what's happening. We know what's happening is that this is a corporate control over our food system, what we're eating. And we're not going to dilly-dally with that water and odor pollution stuff. We're going to chuck that. and we're going to move to something different. And what that different is, we're going to focus on corporations. We're going to focus on this corporate control. So they passed them. We don't think it matters much, but one of the questions that we asked back then was, well, how'd the courts deal with this stuff? You know, it goes through the federal courts and state courts and all those things. Lo and behold, the U.S. Supreme Court, 1948, upheld the legitimacy and constitutionality of these laws, states passing these laws. We think that matters a lot less now. But so we took, what did we do? We took these laws. We took South Dakota's law, which was the most stringent one out there, and we made it into a local ordinance, a municipal law that our folks could adopt. Okay. Just to be a real pain in the butt, we added a citizen supervision, which allowed citizens to sue to enforce the law and not to have to wait for their municipal officials to do it, just to be a pain. And we sent it out there to our folks, these 400 municipal governments that had contacted us to varying degrees about dealing with this problem. And over the next couple of years, close to a dozen municipal governments passed the laws banning agribusiness corporations from owning or controlling farms in 5 counties across Pennsylvania. It was amazing. You drive through these townships, these municipalities, the a handful that had banned agribusiness corporations. In some counties, half the land area was off limits to agribusiness corporations. Half the land area. And while we were doing this work, we also got contacted by a couple hundred municipalities working on sludge issues. Now, what's sewage sludge? Not a great topic to talk about, especially after dinner. But in the United States, we have treatment plants where everything we flush or put down the sink goes to a treatment plant if you're in an area with a centralized treatment system. The brain surgeons that gave us waste management issues around the sludge stuff said, oh, it's just sludge. We'll toss it in the ocean. So we used to dump it in the ocean, late 70s, early 80s. Well, surprise, it killed everything off the coast. So we better switch gears here. So the brain surgeons that gave us ocean dumping of sludge then said, we got it. Let's take that sewage sludge and let's apply it to farmland where we grow our crops. Wow, there's an idea. 60% of all sludge produced by treatment plants is now applied to farmland where crops are grown both for livestock and human consumption. Why is that a bad thing? Well, the sludge stream can contain up to 800,000 different toxic contaminants. 800,000. It's anything people put down the toilet or down the drain. It's chemotherapeutic waste coming from hospital streams, industrial, commercial stuff, all kinds of good stuff. Okay. How many does the DEP or the EPA test for? 11. Okay. In Pennsylvania, we've had 2 kids that died after riding their ATVs through a sludge field. Okay. 2 kids. And that drove a lot of these municipalities and community groups to care about what was in the sludge stream. And they came to us and they said, well, we've heard about this work you've been doing with these agribusiness corporations and municipalities and looking out west and grabbing this stuff back, and we want to do something here. But we don't want to just deal with sludge. We don't want to regulate those 800,000 contaminants. We want to aim at the sludge corporations that are making a mint by being paid by the treatment plants to take the sludge and dump it on farms on the back end to get rid of it. That's how the corporations make money. 3 corporations, major waste management corporations, take in over 80% of the sludge in this country. So these folks said, let's change gears. Let's not regulate this stuff. Let's not trust the Environmental Protection Agency to do anything about it. Let's do it ourselves. And so we drafted a local law that targeted the sludge corporations instead of doing the minimizing adverse environmental impacts by assuming that the stuff would come in the first place. As of last week, 71 municipal governments in Pennsylvania in 11 different counties have adopted that ordinance, all unanimously. So we have over 100 municipal governments in Pennsylvania passing these things that nobody had ever seen before. And they were really dangerous to the boys. We call them the boys, the corporate boys. Really dangerous to the Farm Bureau and to the agribusiness corporations and the sludge corporations, because they're starting to get a little antsy, because there's a fire of some sort that's starting to erupt in Pennsylvania, a little spark in different places where this stuff is starting to gain some ground, and people are having conversations. Having conversations in places where you would not expect, in rural backwoods Pennsylvania, about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution and about their right to take on corporations who were trying to tell them what their community would look like in 40 or 50, 60 years. Conversations I couldn't have anywhere else except in rural South Central and North Central Pennsylvania, in these basements of churches and other places. Now, when a spark like that gets started, the boys know they got to take it out because they can't let anything flower. If let anything flower, it could become something much worse. And so they got to come in and take it out. And the way they started doing that in Pennsylvania was that the lawyers for the agribusiness corporations started threatening our municipal governments. Municipal governments that were thinking about passing sludge ordinances or factory farm ordinances. And it was fascinating because the way that the municipal governments and the rural communities changed the conversation from doing the regulatory stuff to focusing in on the corporations produced a shift of its own within the agribusiness corporations and the way that they were dealing with these issues. When we deal with the regulatory arena, with permit appeals and all the stuff that comes with it, going to regulatory hearings and that type of thing, we're the ones working off a script. The script has already been written. All we do is go through the paces. I've seen the corporate compliance budgets where they write in money for permit appeals. Okay? And not only do they write money in, it's tax deductible as a necessary and reasonable business expense. How stupid are we? How stupid are we? We work off their script under rules that we didn't write, and we expect an outcome different than what those rules were scripted for. What started to happen in Pennsylvania when we changed the script was that the boys started working off of a script that our communities started to write. What do I mean by that? Well, the agribusiness boys came in and said, you municipal officials in Belfast Township, Fulton County, Pennsylvania, south central part of the state, you can't adopt these laws. You lack the authority to adopt these laws. And you know why you lack the authority, the majority of people in Belfast Township, Fulton County, Pennsylvania? You know why? Because if you pass the laws, you're interfering with our corporate constitutional rights. Okay? That's what they said. They didn't have to get to that argument if they were just dealing with parts per million or water or odor pollution or that kind of crap. They never have to get to those arguments, you know, the real bedrock stuff, which is we have more rights than you. We few corporate folks have more rights than the 5,810 people in your township. That's what it comes down to, right? When we're talking about trumping community rights. So our municipalities didn't pay too much attention to most of that stuff. You know, they got the letters, they went ahead and they passed the laws anyway. And as we all know, for every action, there's usually an equal and opposite reaction. And when you're dealing with some of the largest waste management and agribusiness corporations on the planet, the reaction is often unequal, not just equal. They came after us in three ways, because they couldn't let what was happening spread. They came after us with the cultural stuff. Got news for you. We don't have factory farms anymore in Pennsylvania or corporate farms. We have modern farms and advanced farms. And it took us a lot of spending your tax money to pay the PR firm to come up with those words. But how dare you be against modern farming? How crazy are you rural buckaroos to be against advanced farming? Hey, you backwoods folks, you know, this is modern. This progress, man. They came after us through the legislature. They took their boys in the legislature that they supported, and they introduced legislation. And what did that legislation seek to do? They didn't stop short. They sought to strip away the lawmaking power from the municipal governments who had passed the laws in the first place. And not content with that, they added a rider. And the rider said, if you're a municipal government and you pass this ordinance, which we've now determined to be frivolous, you're responsible for paying the attorney's fees incurred by the corporation in bringing the suit in the first place. Okay? We're not just going to be happy stopping these laws from being passed. We got to punish you folks. Because you've dared to break the 21st Amendment, which is our rights trump your rights. And thou shalt never question corporate rights. when it comes to passing these local laws. So legislatively, they came after us. Judicially, they came after us. They sued one of our smallest townships in the smallest, most rural part of Pennsylvania. And the lawsuit was fascinating. Agribusiness boys brought the suit, and they said to the township and the residents of the township, you have no authority to pass these laws because they treat corporations differently from family farmers, and you can't do that because corporations are persons, and you have to treat both of us equally. The argument, of course, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, that corporations claim as persons under the law. Okay. So the court case gets filed, the legislation starts kicking through the Senate and the House. People start coming up to us and they say, oh, Mr. Lindsay, we're really sorry. You know, the legislature's going to take out your program area. And these guys, they have a war chest and they're suing over this ordinance. Geez, you know, we're really sorry you put all this time into it. And we look back at them and say, this is great! It's great for one reason. We took the lawsuit where it says, we are corporations, we are persons, and you can't pass laws that interfere with our rights as persons under the Constitution. And we made a bajillion, gazillion copies of it. And we sent it around to all the municipal governments that we've been working with, and all the citizens in those governments that we are working with. And those folks in those municipalities, they said, now we understand what Tom was talking about. Corporations being persons. It's not some abstract academic concept that folks would learn in law school or in college classes. This is where the rubber hits the road. They're using the Constitution against us. They're using our Constitution against us to stop us from building the kind of communities that we want. What happened with the legislation? Well, the numbers came and went. Senate Bill 826, Senate Bill 1413, House Bill 1222. Upshot of it was, because these folks had made it a democracy issue, because they had transformed what would otherwise have been a single environmental issue into one about rights and rights-based organizing and democratic control, the legislators had to come at them in a certain way to strip away their democratic rights to make law. What did that do in an organizing sense? Well, it got us a lot of allies we normally wouldn't have had if we had made the argument about water pollution or odor pollution or parts per million or particulate matter, because most folks just don't give a crap about those things. Instead, the United Mine Workers came to us and the AFL-CIO. They said, we've got folks getting sick from sludge, and these ordinances are the only things being successful in banning sludge from these areas. The Farmers Union, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, the Pennsylvania Environmental Network, environmental groups came on board. Organized labor came on board. The farm organizations came on board. The good government folks came on board. And for the first time in recorded lobbyist history in the capital of Pennsylvania, they beat back the bills. They beat back the bills. Not just once. Not just once, not just twice. 3.5 years they've kept the legislature from stripping away local control over these issues. 3.5 years. On the judicial side, well, we're litigating right now, but it's fascinating. Because when we switch gears from being an environmental issue to being a democratic one, they had to come after us that way in the courts. So instead of arguing that your ordinance has violated such and such of the environmental regulations, they had to say, hey, the state corporations code trumps your ability at the local level to control corporations. It became a corporate issue, and it became a democracy issue. The shift is well underway in Pennsylvania. Now, the most fascinating part about this work, a couple more minutes of comments, and then we'll bring Richard up here, is that our folks have evolved. The folks that we're working with, we don't push. They push us. So I remember sitting, or standing actually, talking to a group of folks about these single issue ordinances in a place called Clarion County, Pennsylvania. And one of the supervisors, one of the elected officials, stood up and he said, "Well, Mr. Lindsay, this is all well and good, but you know, we can pass these single issue ordinances about sludge and factory farms, but if corporations have constitutional rights to come in and overturn these ordinances or make us spend $500,000 to defend them and reach into tax monies that we don't have, then what good is this?" And we looked back and we said, "What do you want us to do? We did the ordinances. We put the coalition together. We built this coalition and association of municipal governments. What else do you want us to do?" And he said, "We want you to draft a local law that strips away corporate constitutional rights at the municipal level." And we said, "Yeah, we could do that." And so we went back and we drafted up a local law called the Corporate Rights Elimination Ordinance. What does it do? Well, it strips away corporate constitutional rights, including the rights of corporations to claim Commerce Clause and Contracts Clause rights under the Constitution. We sent it out there, didn't know what would happen with it. 2003, two municipal governments in Pennsylvania became the first municipal governments in the United States to adopt laws stripping corporations of constitutional rights in their jurisdictions. It's pretty rarefied air. I drove through those two townships the other day. It's the only place in the United States where corporations don't have constitutional rights. One story. In Clarion County, which is a very rural county in north central Pennsylvania, half of the county, the municipal governments in half the county, have now adopted ordinances banning sludge, sewage sludge, from being land applied in the county. What did the Farm Bureau and the Department of Environmental Protection do when those ordinances were passed or being passed? They sent a delegation into Clarion County to stop them from adopting the ordinances. Okay? And there's in a room where once a year all of the municipal officials gather to listen to speeches and make decisions about certain things, the Department of Environmental Protection guy got up on the stage and he said to the municipal officials that were gathered, he said, "We've heard you folks in Harrisburg, in the Capitol. We've heard you. We've stood there. We've watched you pass the ordinances. We've heard what you have to say. And so what we're doing in Harrisburg right now, we're hiring an additional reviewer to look at the regulatory permits that are being filed by the sludge companies to put sludge in Clarion County. We've heard you. There's no need to pass ordinances here. There's no need to pass these laws that target sludge corporations. We've heard you." Loud and clear. Message sent, message received in Harrisburg. You know what those folks in that room did? They yelled him off the stage. Because they said to themselves, "How silly is that? How silly is that? We're building the communities that we want here by passing law, by making law. And here's this environmental agency telling us that they're going to look at the permits a little more carefully? How silly is that?" One of the supervisors runs out of the room on his cell phone, calls me up, says, "Hey, you never guess what we did? We just shouted the guy down in the room." That's great, okay. So when we took a step back and looked at our work over the past 6 years, we said to ourselves, well, a lot of what we were doing is really defining the types of communities that we wanted by defining what they didn't look like. In other words, the anti-corporate farming laws were saying, we know sustainable communities don't have factory farms, corporate factory farms operating them. With the anti-sludge ordinances, we were saying, well, we know that sustainable communities don't have land-applied sludge coming into them. We were defining the communities we wanted by default, saying what they didn't look like. And so then we said to ourselves, what happens when we start building the types of communities that we do want and outlining what they look like and then putting those into law? And that's where we started to shift gears slightly. 43 states still have these things called home rule provisions. Home rule in the Constitution, home rule in the statutes of the state. What's home rule mean? Well, home rule means that in addition to passing ordinances, you can build your own governments at the local level. You can deconstruct the existing government, and you can build a whole new one. Okay? 43 states. Pennsylvania is constitutionally based. What does that look like? Well, we have a couple communities who are starting the home rule process. It's an initiative referendum process in addition. You don't need the local government officials to do it. The citizens can do it. And in most places, it's 60 to 100 signatures that are needed to build the new government, to put the referendum on the ballot and get it approved. So what does that look like? What happens if we begin to constitutionalize the ordinances that we've been working with over the past 6 years? Not just as ordinances, but writing local constitutions to embody everything we want. Well, what's in those? Well, we decided to put the corporate rights stuff in them because it constitutionalizes it. What else? Well, the rights of nature. We drafted a rights of nature ordinance that recognizes constitutionally based rights on behalf of ecosystems. Okay? It's pretty, you know, forward stuff. What else? Well, how about corporations or a constitutional commission that defines the type of corporations that can do business in the locality and those that can't? Well, that sounds like a good idea. How about creating initiative referenda at the municipal level that we don't have statewide? You can embed them in the home rule charters. Wow, that's some good stuff. That's what the future holds for us in Pennsylvania, is moving in that direction of writing our own local constitutions to take this stuff head on and to constitutionalize the work that we've done over the past 6 years. Now, we shouldn't be lulled into thinking that as we do this work, that the boys are going to let us do it. Okay? Up till now, there's been no price to pay for the boys coming in and overturning an ordinance. No price to pay for the boys asserting their right, illegitimate rights of persons to overturn this decision or that decision, or to use laws that were drafted for freed slaves, for example, to socket to municipal governments for payment of lost profits and attorney's fees. Up till now, there's been no price. But what if the home rule provisions that we're drafting have a provision in there that talk about a right and duty of separation? What happens when there is a price to pay? And that price is the separation of that municipality from the layer of government that's being used by the corporation to sock it to them. What does that look like? And how badly do we want to build the types of communities we want? How badly do we want it? And what kind of price has to be paid when somebody interferes with that building? Okay. The pretty heavy stuff. Now, we used to get phone calls in the office from folks who said, "Hey, we heard what you're doing in Pennsylvania on the radio or TV or newspaper, and we want to replicate that work here. After all, in Pennsylvania, we've done two issues. And those municipalities where we've worked, those local laws have kept that stuff out of those municipalities that have passed those laws. Two issues. There are thousands of single issues out there waiting, demanding to be reframed in a different way that doesn't frame them downward into being single environmental issues, but that frames them upwards and says, we are going to take authority now. Thank you, boys, for being the placeholder. But we're ready to take authority now and to make the rules to build the types of communities that we want in these United States. We used to stay on the phone a lot with folks that somebody one day said, why don't you create a school? A school where people can come and learn what's happening in Pennsylvania and then take it back where we can help them replicate it at home. We said, oh, you think people would come to that? I said, sure. So we opened up the first school at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, 2 years ago. Since then, we've done 33 schools across the United States. By the end of 2005, we'll have 7 permanent schools set up, which include Boston, D.C., Wilson College in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Colorado, and New Mexico. And hopefully the Seattle school, which we're opening this weekend, will become a permanent school as well. We've been amazed by the attention to these schools. We have 100, 150 people waiting to get into them, which floors me, because when we started, we had 6 people attend the first school. It is through that mechanism, that structure, that vehicle, that we are going to help folks who want to be helped to go through the process and figure out how to do this work in a different way. And just to end with this, that a lot of folks find what we have to say frustrating, discouraging, not very hopeful, you know, that things are really screwed. And the only our only option is to start building the types of mechanisms and structures that we want to see. And then when we draw the challenge, to use the challenge to deepen and accelerate this organizing so that we can build the types of communities we want. In reality, it's an understanding that we can't deal with any of these thousands of single issues that people have been valiantly fighting for a number of years until we deal with the power of corporations and the corporate few to define our culture and deny by law our ability to build sustainable communities and protect the natural world. Thank you. Democracy schools are great because we take the onion and we start peeling it back. We spend 5 hours on Pennsylvania. Basically, this happened then, and this happened next, and we have this great 8 boxes on this chart to take people through the organizing strategy. But just like Richard mentioned, that the whole framework rests on producing more. I mean, that's basically the system, and everything else is just an accoutrement or support to that. That it has to touch down, and it touches down in real communities, like a cyclone that touches down. You can't have more production of pork in smaller hands without touching down someplace geographically. I think the only organizing that counts, the only organizing that works, is geographically based organizing, because you have a power plant of people defending their families, their homes, their kids, their land. And that's where you get the real surge that you need to go through those boxes and do the reframing and still have people left at the end. And we just got a small grant last week to do some work around Walmart, to take big box store sightings. And instead of getting crammed into being a land use issue about, well, you have the power to say whether it goes over here or over here, but you don't have the authority to say no. About how to
30,000 square feet.
Or 30,000 square feet versus 100,000 square feet. That to take that issue and reframe it into one about authority to be able to say no, community saying no to a certain type of production, a certain type of retailing. And so that's one of the thousands of single issues that can be reframed. Thurgood Marshall, reading some of his work, understood innately that the courts were political actors. He understood that courts are moved in other ways just by brilliant legal arguments over fine hairs. And the best example was, I think it was called Burlington Parking Garage case, where sit-in protesters were arrested. The restaurant called the police to arrest sit-in protesters for trespassing on restaurant property. And the issue before the court was the restaurant a private entity, private corporation, or a public actor? And it made a lot of difference, because if it was a public actor, it had to respect the rights of the sit-in protesters, constitutional rights of the sit-in protesters. The way that that argument eventually played out in the Supreme Court in that case was the result of 5 years of thousands of cases cluttering the docket in which sit-in protesters were advancing the legal proposition that these restaurants and other public places were actually state actors or public actors. The court went through some contorted reasoning to get to that conclusion, not because they wanted to reach the conclusion, but because they had 1,000 different cases cluttering the dockets below them. So Thurgood Marshall understood very well, in fact, better than almost anyone litigating during that period, that the courts are political actors and have to be shoved and herded in the right direction, because it's certainly not brilliant legal arguments that make law. It's simply the shared values that are driven in through that process. Yes, we have worked with the PERGs, and no, it's not the kind of transition stuff that I think is the work that needs to be done, because it doesn't raise any of the larger questions. We've drafted bad boy laws. In fact, we got our start with 3 strikes and you're out ordinances, which was some of the very early work that we did in 1996, 1997. The problem is you're relying on other places to decide what violations are and what breaches of law are. And so you're still focusing on the illegal behavior, not the lawful behavior. But in addition, it doesn't lead to anything. It basically says everything's fine, we just need to make sure we put repeat offenders in a different category, but we're going to rely on illegal behavior instead of lawful behavior. And so it focuses people in a certain place where they don't question all of the well-settled law, and they don't question corporate rights, and they don't question that stuff. And so it's like conventional organizing taken to the next best, highest level. Conventional organizing taken to the next best level. It's basically doing the same thing, but doing it better. And so when I critique it, I'm critiquing our own work too, because we actually put those laws into place in some municipalities in Pennsylvania. And they were effective in a couple places in keeping things out, but they didn't lead to anything long term in terms of rethinking or doing fundamental work. Not in a formal way yet, because we haven't had really time to codify this stuff, but there has been talk about doing curriculum for mostly elementary school level. But I guess at the end of the day, it's the practicing of democracy by the parents, by the families, that translate the values most effectively to the kids. That's what I've seen, at least. And the democracy schools, amazingly enough, just that they're filled and overflowing and people are trying to get in them, but we had a 15-year-old student, for example, come to the one in Boston, and he went back to his school and began working on some stuff there to gather students together. So I think it's going to happen, but it's going to happen organically in some sense, and it's going to take other folks besides us probably, because we need a bigger army to do the stuff, and it's got to be somebody whose focus is on school-age kids, and then using the examples to basically teach something. But that's about as good as an answer I can give.
What about the media actually reporting these? Is this happening
Yes. The local papers in Pennsylvania have been covering it. The reporters have been following it. And we made it into the New York Times a couple weeks ago about stripping away local control in Pennsylvania. Now with Bill Moyers is covering one of our cases. It's going to air on Friday of next week. It's been very slow for the national media stuff to catch on. The local stuff is penetrating. It's deep. It's comprehensive, especially stuff about the corporate rights ordinances. And so people through internet, I mean, it's all that stuff circulated now across Pennsylvania, but there's a shared consciousness that's growing, but it's certainly not coming from the Los Angeles Times or the, it's coming from the real local papers who are usually locally owned, who are writing about the stories of their own neighbors and community. Ada Funder once asked me, well, where's all this headed? What's the end goal? Where are we at? And I look back and I said, it doesn't matter what I think the end goal is. We involve 5 million, 10 million, 15, 20 million people in this conversation. It's people that decide where this stuff goes. Otherwise, we're just as bad as anybody else in a back room saying, hey, we're going to cut this deal for how we think things should be done. In reality, all this work is about doing is creating a safe space for a process to arise where people voluntarily decide how they want to order their lives and what priorities they're going to give to what the Sioux Indians used to call the flying people and the swimming people and the other ecosystems and animals on the planet. I mean, I think I have a loose vision for where, since we've gone this far, we might as well go the rest of the way. The fact is that communities are going to begin writing their own constitutions. And just like the abolitionists were drafting the language of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments back in the 1830s, 30 to 40 years before the language hit the subcommittee and the committee that was drafting the amendments, that they were tooling the language and building a movement to back the language. Right now, we're at the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, where communities are beginning to draft their fundamental governing frameworks, these constitutions, which eventually, 40 years from now, 30 years from now, will result in states rewriting their constitutions. And eventually, 50 years, whatever the time period, we can imagine, if we have that long on this planet doesn't blow up on us, that the federal constitution will have to be rewritten. I myself, as never thought I'd be here, I'm beyond amending the thing. I think we need a full-blown constitutional convention at the federal level. But I'm in the church. That stuff doesn't happen unless it's driven underneath. And it's got to be forced by enough states doing it. Well, how do you get enough states to do it? You got to have 5,000 communities underneath who are writing this stuff and saying, these are our values, these are our communities, and driving it upwards. I think that's roughly, in the cosmos where I am.